This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's a strange day when the President of the United States goes before a news conference to say, "I am not a dictator." Yesterday came close. Asked if his approving domestic spying by the National Security Agency reflected unchecked power in the White House, the President answered, "To say unchecked power basically is ascribing some kind of dictatorial position to the President, which I strongly reject. In the Constitution and in congressional authorization and in urgent need," said the President, "the NSA wiretaps were justified." But many in the law and Congress and national security say no. Up next on Point, George W. Bush and the exercise of presidential power in the war on terror. Joining me now from Washington is David Cole, professor at Georgetown University Law Center and author of Enemy Aliens, Double Standards, and Constitutional Freedoms in the War on Terrorism. Professor Cole, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
And with us from Charlottesville, Virginia, Robert Turner, associate director of the Center for National Security Law at the University of Virginia. Professor Turner, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
David Cole, I'd like to look at these two prongs that the president puts forward, and the first is the congressional authorization. September 14th, 2001, just days after the 9/11 attacks. David Cole, the president says, look, it's right there. They said, do what's required to respond to this attack, to this threat.
Well, what they said was use all necessary and appropriate military force. And the notion that in doing so, they were somehow implicitly authorizing the president to wiretap Americans without court approval for years to come, I think if they had put that on the table at the time, Congress would have clearly rejected it.
Isn't surveillance part of any military effort?
Well, surveillance abroad on the battlefield certainly is an incident, but surveillance at home of Americans, absolutely not.
But this attack was in the United States. It was on American soil. So doesn't that pull the domestic into it intrinsically?
No, it doesn't. I mean, the attack was on the United States, but the military efforts have been virtually entirely in Afghanistan and abroad and overseas. And there's no real sense in which there's been any battle on the U.S. home front, number one. Number two.
But we saw the towers come down in the United States. I mean, just to make the point, that was not on a battlefield in Afghanistan.
No, that's true. And in any war, it's always possible, of course, that the nation is going to be attacked at home. We were attacked at home during World War II. But would that authorize unlimited domestic spying without court orders? I don't think so. And again, Congress expressly addressed this. This is, you know, the government, the Attorney General saying, well, you should imply from this authority, this broader authority. At the same time, when they ask Gonzales, why didn't you go to Congress and ask for this authority specifically? Why didn't you ask when you went with them with the Patriot Act for an amendment? Why didn't you ask this? He said, we didn't go because we talked to some members and they said they would turn it down if we asked for it. So now they're saying that what he's saying, on the one hand, they gave it to us. On the other hand, if we'd asked for it, they would have turned it down. That you can't make both arguments at the same time.
What about the intrinsic constitutional authority granted to the president as commander-in-chief, also cited by the president yesterday?
Right. Well, there's an authority directly on point. President Truman, during the Korean War, made the same argument. He said, I'm the commander-in-chief. I'm running the war effort. There's a threatened national strike of the steel mills. I'm going to independently and unilaterally seize the steel mills. And it was challenged in the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, you're commander-in-chief of the Army and the Navy. You're not commander-in-chief of the country and its inhabitants. And you don't have the authority to engage in domestic conduct that Congress has expressly considered and rejected. In that context, it was seizing companies during labor strikes. Congress had considered giving the president that authority and had denied it. Well, the same thing is true here. Congress considered giving the president authority to wiretap people during wartime without court order, and they gave it to him, but only for 15 days. And rather than ask for Congress to amend that authority, the president simply ignored it, violated it, and did so, as the Attorney General said, precisely because he knew if he asked Congress to give him the authority, they would have said no.
I want to turn to Robert Turner, but first, David Cole, what do you see happening in this exercise in front of us right now with our understanding of the power of the presidency, or with the facts of the power of the presidency? What's in question here?
Well, I think what's in question is whether we are sort of seeing the resurrection of the imperial presidency in which the president, in the name of national security, bypasses Congress, bypasses courts, and asserts that he has unilateral power to do things not only like spying on Americans, but also, as in the enemy combatant case, to lock up an American arrested on U.S. soil and to deny him any hearing whatsoever, no charges, and to hold him indefinitely, to create secret CIA black sites around the country where we disappear suspects and to inflict torture and cruel and human and degrading treatment on them. These are the kinds of things we've seen from this president in the name of our security. And I think they're unnecessary. I think they're unconstitutional. And I think it's critical that we stand up for a principle of separation of powers and checks and balances. And that's what I think we're beginning to see now that some of this has come to light.
Robert Turner, Senator Russell Feingold, Democrat, Wisconsin, says the president does not get to pick and choose which laws he wants to follow. He is a president, not a king. How do you respond to that?
Well, he has one law he has to follow over all the others, and that's the Constitution. Under our system, throughout our history, presidents have engaged in foreign intelligence gathering during wartime, and this is a period of authorized wartime, just as if Congress had formally declared war. Section 1811 is ambiguous. I read it as saying that the president can gather foreign intelligence without a warrant during wartime for up to 15 days, not that that power expires just 15 days after the war starts, although I agree it's ambiguous. Go back to the very beginning. The Founding Fathers knew about the problem of leaks and congressional leaks. Indeed, Benjamin Franklin in 1776 said that the Committee of Secret Correspondence could not share certain information with Congress because we have found from experience that Congress consists of too many members to keep secrets. John Jay in Federalist 64 talked about sources and methods and there being people abroad who would confide in the president but not in Congress, and said, therefore, the convention have done well in so disposing of the treaty power that the president will be left free to manage the business of intelligence as prudence might suggest.
But the founders had also just thrown off a king. They were very sensitive about presidential or executive authority run amok.
Well, they were, but they also understood, as Locke had taught them and they had learned from their own experience, that in wartime, speed, dispatch, unity of design are critically important. Madison said that had we not had secrecy at the Federal Convention, where there was no national security concern, we would have never had a Constitution. Henry Clay himself, one of the great champions of congressional power, said in 1818 that it would be improper for Congress to inquire into how money was spent in the president's intelligence account. And indeed, if you look at that account, one of the first statutes passed by Congress appropriating money for foreign intercourse, the statute specifically said the president shall account for such expenditures of the said account as in his judgment may be made public and for the amount of other expenditures. In other words, don't tell us the secrets. We can't keep secrets. There was a tremendous experience of leaks coming out of Congress during the American Revolution.
Yep.
They understood that. And the executive power clause in Article 2, Section 1 was interpreted by Washington, Hamilton, Madison, Jefferson, John Marshall himself as giving the president, you know, responsibility for our foreign intercourse.
So we hear that view, and we'll get David Cole to respond as well. But I want to, you put your finger right on this issue of speed and dispatch. The president has made the case that it was apparently what he's suggesting is it wasn't possible to operate under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA, and the oversight of those judges, and still effectively protect the country. I'm sure a lot of listeners are focused on that, wondering, well, is that true or not? Let's try and get closer to that. We're joined now from Washington by James Bamford. He's an investigative reporter who's written extensively about national security issues and the National Security Agency in particular. He's author of A Pretext for War, A Body of Secrets, and The Puzzle Palace Inside America's Most Secret Intelligence Organization. James Bamford, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
So you heard the president and the attorney general saying we could not operate effectively under FISA, under the oversight of this secret court or panel of judges. Does that sound credible to you? Were they too slow? Would it have left the United States open to further attack?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. That's completely specious.
How can you say that so blithely? The president says 2 minutes can make the difference between thousands of Americans dying and not.
Well, then you should read the statute, because the statute gives him that time. He can start immediately. He doesn't have to wait 2 minutes. He can start immediately and then come back 48 hours later and ask for permission. There's nothing that blocks the president from starting eavesdropping immediately, if that's what he wants to do. There's nothing preventing the NSA from turning the switch the minute they see it.
What about the ultimate question of probable cause? Is that burdensome for the executive here?
Listen, this is a court that has granted 19,000 warrants since 1978, and it's turned down five. I don't think this is a court that's awfully onerous.
Did they do it in 2 minutes, or you're saying the time factor isn't really a question here?
The time is absolutely no factor here. When they created this law, they spent a lot of time creating this law, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978, and they took that into consideration. This wasn't the first time. Do you think this is the first president that's ever been a president during a period of a crisis? It's been going on for many years. Every president deals with these things.
So what's your assessment, then? If it's not a practical application that needed more elbow room here, what's your assessment of why this end run on standing law?
Well, there's two possible reasons. One is arrogance of power, which is what George Bush is all about.
But why do that? Let me
finish. He asked this question.
Yes, please.
I'll finish it. One is the arrogance of power, where he pays no attention to laws. You see that with putting Jose Padilla, an American citizen, in jail for 3 years without a lawyer, avoiding the court system. Same thing with putting people in prisons in foreign countries nobody knows about. It's a pattern. That's one possibility. The second possibility is that he has there's a lot of people that he wants to turn the switch on, the eavesdropping switch on, that couldn't possibly be granted warrants under the FISA court because they have nothing to do with terrorism. Those are really the only two possibilities I could think of, and in either case, he's violated the law. There's a very specific statute here that says if you don't go through the FISA court, you're guilty of a felony, and it's 5 years in jail. So this is a very serious matter that has to be taken seriously.
But we had the Lieutenant General Michael Hayden coming out yesterday. Basically, this is former director of the NSA, basically supporting the president. He said the whole key here is agility. It's the aim is to detect and prevent, and sounding supportive of what the president's done.
Well, he has to support him. He was the one who turned the switch. He was the one at the NSA at the time they did this. He has to support it. That's what he was the one who made the decision. The point is, there's three branches of government here. The president enforces the law. He doesn't make the law, and he doesn't decide the law. Those are two other branches. The Congress makes the law, and the judiciary decides the law. He's taking all three branches of government into his own hands there, and that's called a dictatorship, and we don't allow that in the United States. If he has a problem with the law, just like if I have a problem driving 55, I could go change the law or I could go to jail, one of the two, and that's what his options are.
Take your pick, says James Bramford, investigative reporter, author of Body of Secrets in the Puzzle Palace. Mr. Bramford, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
David Cole, Robert Turner says speed and dispatch are required, and look back to the founding fathers. They knew in the Constitution, he says, that this power needed to reside in the hands of the president, the executive.
Well, I think James Bramford laid to rest the speed and dispatch concern. That clearly, the FISA process permits speedy dispatch. With respect to the concerns about the executive running the war and being able to do so with secrecy, of course, I don't think anybody's disputing that. No one's suggesting, for example, that the president has to give us the names of every person who was surveilled, that the foreign intelligence surveillance taps should be public. What they're saying is the authority for doing so should be the subject of public debate. And the notion that we can't have public debate about whether the president should be given unchecked authority to wiretap Americans indefinitely, that is completely, that just can't be squared with the democratic process. You have to be able to have a debate about that.
Now, President Bush says, well, if we'd asked Congress for this authority, that might have tipped off al-Qaeda.
Mm.
But that's clearly not his real motive in not asking Congress. His real motive is what Gonzalez said, which is that they knew Congress would say no. Because 1 week after September 11th, they gave Congress a bill of particulars, everything they said they needed. It was called the Patriot Act,
mm-hmm.
including specifically expansions of FISA, to include the library's provision, to include easier access to using these wiretaps in criminal investigations, and Congress gave them most of what they asked for. Had they asked for this authority, maybe Congress would have given it to them, but I think probably not, because it's such an unchecked and open-ended authority. So instead of asking Congress, they had a vehicle to ask Congress, but instead of asking them when they knew that they might be turned down, he's decided to simply violate the law. That's just not the way you proceed in a democracy, even during wartime.
Robert Turner, James Bamford says speed and dispatch couldn't have been the issue, that there's plenty of room for that in the FISA legislation. So what motivation?
The courts have distinguished between different reasons for wiretaps. Wiretaps for criminal prosecution purposes have a higher standard. The Supreme Court has never held that the president could not engage in warrantless wiretaps for national security purposes involving foreign agents, foreign governments, and collaborators. The two circuit courts of appeals that addressed the issue upheld that as an independent presidential power under the Constitution. The issue here is not, is the president breaking the law, but which law is to control the Constitution, which gives the president control of our foreign relations in Article 2, Section 1, or statutes of Congress, which are not valid if made contrary to the Constitution.
We're joined right now from Washington by Brad Berenson. He was associate counsel to the president from 2001 to 2003, during the time when this NSA program got launched. Brad Berenson, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
So here we are, the president vigorously defending the steps he's taken yesterday. Do you have a sense, when this policy was promulgated in the White House, that the gravity of what was being undertaken was front and center on people's minds?
Well, I was not aware of this program when I was inside the White House, and so I was not actually a participant in any of these discussions, but I can virtually guarantee you from other issues in which I was a participant that the legal aspects of this were taken very, very seriously, and the president and the attorney general have said as much in recent days. The president sought advice from his top legal advisors, his White House counsel, his attorney general, asking if this was a lawful thing to do. He was told by both of them, after I'm sure very careful deliberation, that it was. And, you know, the president is not a lawyer. He's entitled to rely on the advice of his top lawyers, and that's what makes any talk of impeachment absolutely far-fetched and fanciful. One might disagree with the legal opinions he received. That's a fair subject for debate. But even if one disagrees with those legal opinions, it doesn't mean that the president himself has done anything wrong. In fact, he did it exactly right. He asked his attorney general, can I do this? And the answer came back yes.
But of course, of necessity there, he's asking people that he put in power. Brad Berenson, let me ask you the interpretation over the last few days. Since the New York Times broke this story on Friday, one stream of interpretation has been that this White House has been very deliberately expanding the powers of the presidency as a matter of principle, that they wanted to do this, they thought it was necessary, and this is another example of that. What about that? You were on the inside. Was that the tenor, the tone, the drive to scratch back more presidential power?
Well, there's no question but that this administration from the start believed that a lot of ground had been lost in the realm of executive power over the Clinton years and years prior, and that it would be in the public interest and a good thing for the executive branch to reclaim some of those powers. But 9/11 and its aftermath have not really been the occasion for any dramatic expansion of presidential power, because the plain fact is that in time the president's powers in the realm of foreign affairs and national security are extremely broad, and never more so than in time of war. The president has just been exercising the traditional authorities available to him, and in that regard, it's very important to make a distinction that hasn't been made so far in this conversation.
Yes.
This is not domestic surveillance or domestic spying. This is not spying on U.S. persons. Each and every one of the calls that was monitored here, according to the Attorney General and the head of the NSA, either originated or terminated abroad with a suspected al-Qaeda agent. This is international communications.
Yes, but it certainly gets into what was traditionally defined as domestic surveillance. I mean, it is U.S. persons who are on one end of these phone calls. Among them, we're told, American citizens.
Right. There are U.S. persons who are parties to these phone calls, but they are not being surveilled for their domestic activities. The only communications that are being surveilled pursuant to this program, based on what's been revealed are communications, international communications, with people that our intelligence community had reason to believe were agents of al-Qaeda itself.
David Cole,
so
does that make it...
a very particular communication.
We take that. David Cole, does that make it not domestic surveillance? And does that put it back in the realm of foreign surveillance?
No, absolutely not. I mean, on that argument, the president could simply open every letter that anybody sends outside of the country, or could read every email that someone sends out of the country, or that even goes through a server outside of the country. And there's no warrant for that. And in fact, the Supreme Court has held that your protections include conversations that go across the border. So and FISA contemplates that. So I don't think the fact that you're talking to someone over the border gives our government any greater authority to intrude on that conversation or intrude on your privacy without having judicial approval.
We've got a lot of listeners who want to join this conversation. Eli is calling from Washington, D.C. Hi, Eli. You're on the air.
Tom, thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you. What do you think?
I just got back from Middlebury College, where I took a class called The American Presidency.
Mm-hmm.
The point of this class was to empathize with the decisions of the president.
Mm-hmm.
While I disagree with a lot of what George Bush has done in office, I can empathize with this decision. Article 2 of the Constitution, Pearl Harbor, September 11th, the president has a new role to protect the people of the United States. Had there been another September 11th, people would have been saying, what are you doing, Bush? Why aren't you protecting us more? And this wouldn't even be an issue.
Now, Eli, I understand that sentiment. Let me just ask you, we heard James Bamford, who's followed the NSA very closely, say earlier, yes, but this wasn't necessary. They could have gotten everything they needed within the bounds of law as stated in 1978.
There are two points to this. One, no one has the vantage point of the president. No one knows what is going on in this country better than the president. No one knows the best action to pursue.
But what does that mean? You know, I wonder what the king is thinking tonight. I mean, because we can't know every thought, does that mean off you go, Mr. President, whatever you like?
No. Secondly,
this is Brad, I want to endorse what Eli's saying. I mean,
mm-hmm.
It's very difficult until you've worked in the White House to appreciate just how different a lot of these issues look from that vantage point. I mean,
mm-hmm.
when you are the person entrusted by the Constitution,
it's your job,
with the responsibility for protecting the safety of the American public in the wake of a catastrophe like 9/11, you feel a keen personal responsibility to do everything you can within the bounds of the law to save the lives of the next 3,000 American citizens, spare those families that grief. And so, you know, we should expect our president to be aggressive in trying to protect us from foreign threats of this nature.
But Brad Berenson, let me ask you, 9/11 was unique in that it was right there in Manhattan, but we'd been through wars before. After the Vietnam War, Congress specifically laid down laws because of what had happened during that war, and as David Cole was saying, with a kind of a explicit sense of the kinds of circumstances that war can create, and said, even so, this is how we want this pursued.
Mm-hmm.
Can the president even turn that over?
Right. Well, as usual, David makes a very reasonable, sound, and respectable argument. There's nothing wrong with the argument that he makes, but it's not definitive. It doesn't end the issue, and the reason is twofold. First, FISA itself says you have to conduct yourself in accordance with the provisions of this statute unless otherwise authorized by law. And the administration and its lawyers believe that the congressional authorization for the use of military force after 9/11, which talked about empowering the president to detect and prevent further acts of terrorism on our soil and granted him the power to use all necessary and appropriate force to do that, the administration believed that that constituted the other authorization under law that FISA specifically contemplated could allow you to work outside the FISA regime.
Mm.
Second, even if they were wrong about that, the president does have inherent authority under Article 2 as Commander-in-Chief, and there are laws of Congress that can violate that authority. That is, if there's a clash between the president's constitutional powers and a statute of Congress, it isn't automatic that always the statute of Congress wins.
But shouldn't there be a conversation?
Pardon?
Shouldn't there be a conversation? Congressmen are saying, we didn't really even understand what was going on here. It was so vaguely portrayed.
Well, there was a conversation. I mean, to its credit, the administration briefed rather extensively up on the Hill leaders of both parties more than a dozen times about this program.
But among those number are congressmen saying now, it was so vague, they didn't really ask our permission, we didn't really know what was going on, we couldn't judge. We had congressmen writing that even before this became public.
Well, there were some congressmen who were briefed who expressed concern, many others of both parties who apparently did not. Some say they didn't understand. Many are not making that claim.
Mm-hmm.
But the administration did go brief the Congress. They did brief the chief judge of the FISA court. All three branches of government were made aware of this program. It's not as though the White House was doing this in the dark without accountability or knowledge of anybody else in government.
And certainly the responsibilities were grave. Eli, thank you for your call. Robert Turner, let me put this to you sort of atmospherically here. To one side, we've got the report today that the FBI, quite apart from this NSA authority, but maybe it speaks to it, has been involved in surveillance and intelligence gathering operations of groups in environment and animal cruelty and poverty relief that they've been looking in the last few years on vegans in Indianapolis, on the Catholic Workers Group, on people for the ethical treatment of animals. Isn't this a kind of reminder of how easily this can spin out of control?
Well, you may be right in that. I haven't looked at that case, but we're missing some context here.
Mm-hmm.
For over 200 years, it was understood in our country that intelligence was an exclusive presidential prerogative. Congress did not interfere when it came up. Senior leaders of Congress said, this is given to the president by the Constitution. We can't touch it.
But then they did, 1978.
Mm-hmm. But since 1978, the landmark Supreme Court case on national security wiretaps was the Keith case in 72. In that, Justice Powell said, we express no opinion as to the issues which may be involved with respect to activities of foreign powers or their agents. And since FISA was enacted, two courts of appeals, the Fifth Circuit in Brown, held that the president had independent constitutional authority to authorize warrantless wiretaps for foreign intelligence purposes. And in 1980, the Fourth Circuit upheld warrantless surveillance where the target is a foreign power, its agent, or collaborators, and was done primarily for foreign intelligence rather than law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what we're talking about here, Al-Qaeda people we've identified as Al-Qaeda people, are making phone calls or sending emails to unknown Americans. We are at war. People are trying to kill us, and people are saying we should impeach the president for trying to find out what is being said. Under FISA, to get a warrant, you have to show probable cause that the American, the U.S. person involved, is working with, is an agent or whatever.
Is that too much to ask?
You don't know that until you spend some time and find out about that person.
Mm-hmm.
In war, you want to listen to what our enemies are saying to Americans and then decide whether they're, this idea that we don't tell privates they have to go back to Congress or to the courts before they can shoot an enemy soldier. In war, you have to move quickly. And this idea that Congress has a right to amend the Constitution to take away the president's power, and to impose a court in this setting saying we don't want our president listening when Al-Qaeda operatives are calling people we don't know in this country, that strikes me as an awfully good prescription for another 911.
David Cole, how about it? We've got White House officials telling the New York Times that this program that the president put forward secretly helped uncover a plot by Ayman Ferris, an Ohio truck driver, naturalized U.S. citizen, supporting Al-Qaeda, planned to bring down, these unnamed officials say, planned to bring down the Brooklyn Bridge with blowtorches, and this presidential program helped set that aside. Robert Turner says there are plenty of court precedent, Supreme Court and otherwise, opinion that would support him in that. Do you agree?
Well, first of all, the plot to bring down the Brooklyn Bridge with an acetylene torch says more about Ayman Ferris's sanity than it does about
that's a lot of blowtorching
security. But secondly, I think Robert Turner's argument demonstrates the very danger of the slippery slope. He says, well, if we can shoot the enemy on the battlefield, then surely the president can also wiretap Americans' phones without warrants and without any sort of judicial supervision whatsoever, and in the face of an express rejection of that authority by Congress. And again, I come back to the basic point. Look, if
the president felt he needed this power. He had a vehicle to ask Congress to give it to him. And when asked why they didn't do that, Alberto Gonzalez said, well, we talked about doing that, but members of Congress said it would be difficult, if not impossible, to get that authority from Congress. So instead of going through the democratic process and making the argument that this is necessary after 9/11 and risking rejection, they simply took the alternative route of violating a law, a criminal law, and acting in secret. And no, they did not notify Congress. If they had notified Congress, they would have risked rejection. They talked to a few members of Congress in classified communications, which the members of Congress then couldn't share with their compatriots who don't have the same classification authority.
Brad Berenson, we've just got a minute left here. The president says the war on terror may be long. Robert Turner says there's a constitutional authority here that predates 1978, the experience of the Vietnam War. Are we going to need to have, in your view, as someone who was in the Bush White House, a different kind of presidency in this century, a more powerful presidency, what critics might call an imperial presidency?
Well, I think it's a very traditional presidency during wartime. In fact, President Bush's exercises of power in the context of the war on terror have been rather modest compared to some of the powers that were exercised by President Lincoln during the Civil War, by President Roosevelt during World War II. I mean, what President Bush has done all across the board, if you add up all of the complaints that the Bush administration critics have.
And there are a lot now.
And there are a lot, but they don't begin to approach the wartime powers exercised by previous presidents.
Well, there's a lot for Americans to weigh in their own hearts and minds. With that, we're out of time. Brad Berenson, Associate Counsel to the President, 2001-3, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Robert Turner at the University of Virginia, thank you for joining us, Professor Turner.
Enjoyed it. Thank you.
And David Cole at Georgetown University Law Center. David Cole, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.